In this podcast, we're going to be asking you to pause and reflect on some of the changes that might have taken place to your practice, to your workplace as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. We're going to be using a framework developed by the Royal Society of Arts in the UK, which looks at responses to crisis and to try and make the case and the argument for positive change. So I think something that both Michael and myself are interested in is kind of disrupting the status quo. And it seems like there's a real opportunity here because the status quo has been disrupted anyway. And so rather than just kind of meekly fall back in line with how things have always been, to use this as an opportunity for change. And so what we're hoping that to get you to do is to sort of walk with us as we talk through some of the changes that we've identified to our own workplace, think about ones for yourself, and then come together with us in the synchronous discussion where we'll sort of have a look and see what the themes are across all of the participants at the UN conference.
I think one of the things that I've noticed in conversation with colleagues is that there seems to be this desire to get back to the way things were and to forget about all the changes that have been made, including the ones that are quite positive. You know, we think about the disruption that's happened in our lives, in our practice, in our teaching, in operations, and we think of these as having introduced difficulty, problems, hardships. And, you know, what we don't often see, we don't always see, is the idea that some of these things are actually, we should have dropped them a long time ago. And I think that this framework for me has really given some structure to the way that I think about how to move forward in a positive and constructive way, rather than only looking at the crisis in negative terms.
Yeah, I think that's really true. But I think what's probably also important to remember, and I think that I forget is also that this has been like a really challenging process though, and so it's not necessarily the case that we want to change absolutely everything, because that the pace of that change has been quick. That's great, because it creates the opportunity to not backslide and to embed some of the things that have been good. But it's also not necessarily about sort of continual revolution. There could be a point now where we can sort of evolve on some of the changes that we've had to make in the short term, to work out which of those we want to stick, which of those we want to progress further, and how we can marry those up with the sort of best of what we had before.
Okay, so with that in mind, what we're going to be asking you to do is to think carefully about some of the things that you have changed in your departments, in your practice, and to make a list of those changes. And these are things that may have been informed by some of the beliefs that you have. They may have just been decisions that were taken out of your hands. Could have been changes in the relationships that you have with other people. So it's quite broad in how we think about what these changes were.
So what we're going to do is at this point we're going to pause. There's going to be a brief pause on the podcast, but actually we probably suggest that you press pause and think about spending sort of 10, 15 minutes to come up with a list. That list could be down to the very specific changes that you've made to your teaching practice. It might be about actions. It might be about the way that you've had to change the delivery of content or assessment. But it could also be more about changes that you've picked up on and noticed in terms of the behaviours or in terms of the sort of underlying beliefs about education and how we practice and how those things might have shifted. The idea at this point isn't to attach any value to those. We just want a list of things that you have identified that have changed. And it may well be that there are some of those on that list that you feel positive about and some of those that you feel less positive about. And that's something that we're then going to get you to sort of map out and dig further into as we go through. Okay, so we're going to pause now and start to come up with our lists. We're going to suggest that that you find somewhere comfortable to sit. You're going to want to write this down. It doesn't have to be on a computer. It could be on a pad, but somewhere where you've sort of got a list that you're then going to be able to come back to as we work through the next sort of steps of the framework and the podcast. So we'll see you in about 10, 15 minutes once you've got a list of some of the changes that you've identified from your practice.
Welcome back. I hope that you've got your list with you, because what we're going to be doing now is talking about some of the practices that we started as a result of the pandemic and the lockdown, and some of the practices that were stopped. Now, some of those activities that you started would have been temporary, only relevant for the duration of the pandemic. And these are the things that we're going to probably look at starting up again. And then some of the other practices that were introduced during the pandemic would have been things that we think are really innovative. And that you want to carry on doing as we move into the future. Some of the activities that were stopped, I think on reflection, you might realize that some of those things were obsolete. They were based on momentum or habit. And there's no real reason for us to start those again. And those are the activities that we want to remain stopped. They're obsolete. And then there are some activities that we put on pause because we weren't able to do these things during the lockdown. And these are the activities that we might want to restart in some form or another. So those are the four blocks in the matrix, the framework that we're talking about. And what Ben and I are going to do now is talk about the lists that we came up with and how we made decisions about which of these items would go into which of the blocks. We'll chat a little bit about each one of the blocks, and then we'll pause to give you an opportunity to go back and look at your own lists and see which of which parts of the framework you think your activities need to go into.
Okay, great. So shall we start by looking at the things that we started in response to the pandemic? And then we can sort of split those into the ones that that we don't think have much kind of ongoing value and we'd want to end, and then maybe move on to thinking about the ones that we'd want to amplify and sort of, you know, either continue with or potentially even grow further. So what did you have down from your list that you moved into the activities that you'd want to end now that, or at the point at which we can begin to end these?
This is something that I struggled with the most. You know, it took me a while to think of something where I could think we want to stop this. I think most of what we've started in our department is quite innovative responses to the pandemic, and I'm not quite sure that there's anything that we wanted to stop completely. The only thing I really think of, which is relatively obvious, is, you know, we obviously can't move forward with 100% online all the time. So, you know, we are a practical program, a professional program, and I think it would be difficult to move the entire program online. And so that idea of running everything online all the time, I think, is the one thing that's going to end. But I don't think that that's specific to us. What about you?
So I think I had the same kind of difficulty in terms of this was the hardest block to fill. And what was noticeable, I think, to myself as I was working through was that the things where I had more individual control over them, I was generally kind of quite happy with stuff I'd introduced, and there wasn't many things that I'd introduced that I wasn't trying to take the opportunity to put something in that I might carry on with. So the stuff that was sort of brought in that I would be looking for when it can end was probably the more institutional level things. So similarly to what you were talking about there about the sort of the 100% move online, the approach that we took at Birmingham was to go to sort of or aim for 100% asynchronous delivery. In the kind of immediate, you know, aftermath of sort of when we did the pivot to online, for some really good reasons, and I think we've talked before about the kind of need to be thinking equitably and thinking about access and how students are going to be engaging, and so that I think there's some good principles underlying that move.
I agree completely. You know, thinking back on what I was saying. The thing that I struggled with the most as well were the changes that were mandated. And, you know, the ones that you have the least control over are probably the ones that are the ones that need to end. Whereas, as you were saying, the changes that I made in my own practice, those are the kinds of things that I think I would definitely like to carry on. It's almost like the lockdown and the pandemic, the institutional changes, they opened up a space for us to experiment at an individual level, and maybe those are the kinds of things that we'd like to see carrying on, whereas we have no control over what's going to happen at the institutional level, and those are probably the things that are going to end immediately. And also, they're probably the things that are kind of the biggest changes. You know, we have no capacity to mandate that our programs go fully online or fully asynchronous. We can't change the timetable in our own personal capacity. And so maybe those kind of really big, really kind of significant changes that happened at the institutional level or at the professional level, maybe those are the ones that are going to be the first to go back to normal. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, I think, I mean, really it's what we're seeing is that you can't have a sort of absolute response that sort of is quite a simplistic response to something that we know is complex. So we know that our programs need to be complex and need to have, you know, a range of different facets. And so narrowing that right down has been, you know, more tricky. I guess what I'm interested in to see is that I think that we're perhaps both people who would have tried to seize on this opportunity to like implement some change and to sort of push things forward, but whether there might well be other people who do feel like they had to make changes which they were you know, maybe felt less in control of or would want to roll back at. And also, you know, like it might just be luck that I'm broadly happy with the things that I've brought in, and we shouldn't expect that we get stuff right first time. So, you know, I'm interested to hear from other people about the things that we've maybe tried that actually just didn't really work. I think there could be some really rich learning from that. So what we're going to do now is to pause and throw it over to you. So we want you to look back at the list that you came up with and have a think about, of the items that you've got in that list, what would you put into that top left box of things that you would want to end once we're at a point to do so. It may be that you look at your list and think that there isn't anything on that list. Our conversation might have prompted some other thoughts, and that's absolutely okay to bring other things in too. We'll see you back in a couple of minutes. Okay, welcome back. So we're going to think now about the things that we started that we think have merit and that we'd want to carry on with. So these are going in the amplify box in the top right. And I think as we touched on earlier, I mean, certainly for me, this was the box that I had less difficulty filling. I had loads of stuff that I could have put in there. I've got in there about increasing collaborative working using online tools. Certainly, as we're moving now into the sort of more embedded phase, so rather than the initial crisis response, the flipped classroom approach, I've definitely made more use of that. It's been a real opportunity to get involved with that, and as an approach to assessment and thinking about open book exams. This has been something that's been really, really positive. The thing that I was going to focus on was around the opportunity to use environment and get the students to sort of engage with where they are when they're not in the classroom to enhance learning. So I had a couple of activities that were looking at sort of disability and impacts of disability, and actually having students complete them asynchronously in their own homes really provided an opportunity to get them to reflect on how disability might affect them and the impact it would have on sort of life, environment, activity and participation in a way that doing it in a sort of practical room or in a classroom would have been much more tricky to do. How about you, Mark? What did you have in that box?
I agree. This was definitely the area where I almost want to say had the most fun. I really enjoyed thinking about all the changes that we had made, and not only continuing with those changes, but as the framework suggests, amplifying them. How do we actually look for opportunities to do more of these things? One of the things that we did at my institution was we had to provide data and devices to a lot of our students. And so we had to cancel some of the kind of building programs that had been planned at the institutional level to free up funding to buy laptops and data just for, you know, massive numbers of students who had to now switch to online learning, but they had, you know, some of our students live in places where there's no cell phone signal, let alone the internet. So, you know, that was something that I think we need to look at as an institution. How do we make sure that we provide the necessary hardware for our students and access to the internet, so that if we are going to continue with some of these kind of more blended approaches to learning, we aren't going to be leaving students behind. So that's something I'd like to see happen at an institutional level. We obviously also looked at alternative forms of assessment and changes to the clinical program. One of the things that we've decided or that we have actually implemented was moving students into private practices, just because there were some of our public sector placements that we couldn't put students into. So I thought that was pretty exciting. And we're actually getting really good feedback from our students. So that's great. From an operational point of view, we shifted our entire department to working remotely overnight. And I think we've learned a lot from that process. And I think the idea that you have to be on campus 5 days a week from, you know, this hour to this hour, I think that's going to go away. And in my department, we're definitely going to be looking at keeping the more flexible timetable for staff and maybe even for students. But I think the thing that I really got the most out of, and I think that colleagues in the department got the most out of, was this kind of principle that we decided right at the beginning, which was family first. And, you know, we recognize that people are going to be working at home, very different environments, kids, they're homeschooling, you know, partners and spouses are at home, sometimes they're working full time as well. And we recognized very early on that we cannot have any expectations that staff members are available between certain working hours. And we just took the decision that nobody should have to make the decision. Nobody should have to make a choice between their family and work. And we said that in those situations, it's going to be family first every time. And I think as a department, we're going to double down on that. So moving forward, we're going to look for more opportunities to make sure that personal well-being, mental health, family relationships, we're going to try and figure out how we can keep the program operational while at the same time privileging those personal connections between people. So I think that's something that we're most excited about in my department.
And it sounds to me like that's something where it's kind of reflecting the broader societal shift in sort of values, really. It feels like certainly in the UK that's not something that's happening just in higher education. It's happening across sectors that we've seen a bigger shift towards working from home and getting the balance right and that greater flexibility, and maybe that's really accelerated a movement that was happening. So I, you know, it was interesting when you were sort of saying there that actually maybe this is something we can broaden and think about how the flexibility relates to students too, not just staff. Was there anything in particular you were thinking about there? Or?
Well, I mean, for a while I've been wanting to, well, I actually say to my students, you know, if you don't get value from my classes, please feel free to do something else. And I don't say it in a sarcastic kind of condescending way. You know, really, if coming here and being in the class with me for an hour is not a good use of your time, then, you know, do something else. Do something else that's going to give you more satisfaction. I guess it works. You know, I've got kind of lower attendance, I guess, than other lecturers. But in terms of the quality of the work that the students do, you know, that's really what I'm looking at. They're sitting in a desk from, you know, 9 o'clock to 10 o'clock on a Tuesday morning. You know, that really says nothing to me about, you know, their engagement, what they're learning. You know, so why not give them the opportunity to, you know, have a job, to look after a sibling, or, you know, whatever personal need they have. You know, why should we mandate that learning about ethics should happen on a Tuesday morning from 9 till 10? It just seems bizarre.
Sure. And I mean, it just feels like there's a real opportunity to move away from sort of presenteeism, both from staff, but also from students, you know. So yes, I turned up to all the sessions that you put on and I signed in, because we still make students sign in, you know, like they're in primary school. Whereas actually this way around, it's like, look, the material's there, the opportunities are there for you to engage in. And if you do, then this is the process that we're going to have. But it actually treats, I think, the students more like adults. And that shift seems like a sort of really positive one, as you say, at that sort of bigger picture level. Okay, great. One of the things that just popped into my head as you were talking was also around how, like, this is going to be an ongoing process, because we're going to have to wait and see a little bit about what practices that are taking place in clinical practice get amplified as a result of changes. So certainly we've seen a big shift to virtual consultations and more you know, both assessment and intervention being delivered remotely. And whether or not, you know, how much of that sticks is going to have then probably a big impact on what we have to think about in terms of the learning that prepares students for that. So, you know, the interplay between clinical practice and what gets amplified there with how we need to adapt our learning to respond to that, I think is also a really interesting, you know, place for change.
Yeah. There's something I've been thinking about that I haven't really seen reflected in any of the online conversation, but, you know, people are talking about tele-rehabilitation, seeing patients remotely, and something that, you know, hasn't really come up, but, you know, is going to come up, is what's going to happen when South African physiotherapists, for example, start seeing UK-based patients and start charging a vastly reduced rate. You know, and in those situations, like, we've got no guidelines for what rules apply. Who's responsible? Where does data reside? Under what country? You know, so that is going to happen, because guaranteed this is going to become more common practice. You're going to have patients seeing someone who they are most comfortable seeing, or who charges a lot less. At the moment, there's a lot of business that's driven by geography. And if you've got a practice in an affluent area, you're going to be fine. What happens when someone from India starts seeing your patients at home, and is, you know, it's more convenient for the patient, it suits their needs, they charge you know, much less. So I haven't seen anyone engaging with those conversations, and it is absolutely going to happen. And I don't see any way that you could stop it.
That's interesting. I've seen a few discussions at the level of insurance, and kind of from UK physio saying, well, am I insured to go and to start to do assessments for someone in a different country. But you're right, you know, so this is going to be a sort of ongoing process, and we're going to have to continue to respond, I think, in education to these shifts which are happening out there. Okay, should we let's pause our conversation there, throw it back over to you, the listener. So what we'd like you to do now is, again, go back to your list. Think about which of the things you're gonna want to amplify. What are you gonna want to take forward, either in the same format that it's in now, or that you're gonna even want to progress further in the future. And we'll see you back in a couple of minutes.
Okay, welcome back. We're now going to move on to the activities that we stopped within our departments and our practices. And, you know, with the understanding that some of these things are just obsolete and they should remain stopped. But then there are other activities that, you know, we've stopped out of necessity and which we really need to get going again in some form or another. So we're going to start with the activities that are obsolete. And I mean, for me, the obvious one was just the idea that we should have lectures as information transfer. You know, we require that students come and sit in a classroom for an hour, sometimes 2 hours, and we talk to them. We in the worst cases, we just read the slides to them. And every now and again, someone has a question and we answer the question. Maybe we expand a little bit on the slides. And one of the things that I think absolutely has to stop is the idea that we require students to come into a classroom and listen to us talk to them. You know, it's different if you're discussing patients, if you're giving students the opportunity to bring up problems and you can have like collaborative problem solving. I think I'll talk about that a little bit in the next block. But this idea that we get students into the classroom and we literally just, you know, transfer information from our slides into their notes, that's something that we need to just make sure never starts again.
You're not going to find any disagreements with me on that, and that was definitely something I had down. So at a sort of personal level, looking at a sort of first year anatomy module, so certainly wanting to end the practice of sort of big lectures. So we combine sort of sports and exercise science students and physio students, so you'd have sort of 200 odd students, you know, in a lecture being told about the musculature of the lower limb or whatever it might be, and so that feels like something which, you know, there's a real opportunity here for us to let go of that, and it wasn't serving all of the students as well as it could do in the first place, and that was acknowledged, but it was hard to see how you could make things work without it. Whereas what we're seeing with the move to a more flipped approach for that sort of initial concept that we can then, as you say, spend the time in the classroom discussing and applying in some way. The sort of big lecture. I mean, I'm fascinated by what this might mean for what campuses look like. Are we going to see a reduction in the need for sort of big lecture theatre space in the future, or are we going to, you know, gradually fill them all sort of back up again? And, you know, it'd be nice to think that they could become redundant or at least kind of lessened in their ubiquity, maybe.
Well, you know, I think, right at the beginning, you talked about how, you know, everyone's going to have different approaches to, you know, where they put their activities in this framework. And I think for many colleagues, you know, what we're talking about ending now, they're looking at as a temporary measure. And, you know, this kind of lecturing is going to be the first thing that they put into the top left box. This is something that they had to end lectures, and as soon as they're allowed to, they're going to continue with those lectures. From my personal perspective, I don't see much value in that activity. Without a doubt, there are a lot of people who, you know, for whom this is a nightmare, and they just can't wait to get back into class so that they can start their normal lecturing. I don't see that there's going to be massive changes to, you know, campus infrastructure. I think there's far too many people who are happy to just continue with the momentum of higher education as it currently exists.
I think you're right, but I think where that might not be the case is where it's driven by what the expectations that are brought by students. So all students have now had at whatever level some taste of what online learning might look like, and that may have been positive, it might have been negative, but do we start to see a sort of shift in those expectations, you know, about what constitutes value and what guides the sort of choices that students make? So that I think that's not going to be an immediate change, but it may be something that does, you know, we do sort of start to see some of those. It will depend on whether or not those sort of societal beliefs, like we were talking earlier about the sort of ideas around presenteeism and work from home and flexibility around that, whether we see some of those kind of foundational beliefs shift around what education ought to look like in terms of what choices then students make.
I actually thought you were going to say, you know, what are the changes that come about as a result of institutional kind of mandates? And it may be that some forward-thinking institutions kind of look back at the programs that have been running over the last few months and say, you know what, we actually don't want you to carry on with the way that you've been doing things. And so if we look at institutional operating policies, teaching and learning guidelines, we may see some forward-thinking institutions actually start encouraging lecturers. I don't think that they can make it a rule, but you know, they could start encouraging lecturers to move in the direction that we're suggesting. And so it may not be enough to kind of change everything, but it may just kind of drive enough of a wedge into the status quo that, you know, we create some room to move. Okay, cool. Was there anything else in that area that you wanted to mention?
I think the other thing kind of, and this is where we're sort of probably already starting to see that some of these ideas that it depends on the perspective you look at them through in terms of which box they end up in. So there was some overlap with some of the thoughts I'd had about wanting to amplify open book sort of assessment approaches, and maybe wanting to let go of, so the kind of MCQ exams where we'd bring all the students into a computer room to complete the exam in the room together, because like we've got to control it and make sure that no one's cheating, and that is quite a time consuming effort. It for an exam that kind of skews heavily towards kind of rote learning and recall rather than application. And so for me in this box, there's an opportunity there to let go of something which takes up space on campus, takes up time for, you know, kind of invigilation, takes up to, you know, kind of all this sort of administrative burden of assessment, and being able to sort of switch that over to something which I think is more aligned with how the learning, you know, is happening and that we want to happen for clinical practice. So that was the other one that I had in that box.
I absolutely agree. And, you know, just as you were talking about something that we should think of as obsolete, you mentioned cheating. And, you know, this is kind of a pet peeve of mine. You know, we look at, you know, three or four clinicians sitting on a ward talking about a particularly difficult clinical case, and we say, wow, that's a really good example of excellent clinical practice. And when our students do the same thing, we call it cheating. And it just seems like such a bizarre disconnect between what we expect from people once they graduate and how we train people. You know, the idea that you should have, you know, a certain corpus memorized so that you can draw on it just in case you need it one day is baffling to me. And yet that's the expectation with assessment. You know, sit down for 3 hours and kind of reproduce everything that you've memorized. You know, if you're lucky and you have a forward-thinking lecturer, you might be asked to apply what you've memorized. But it starts with the memorization of certain facts, and then you're asked to apply that to a clinical problem. So, you know, why not let go of the idea that there is cheating? Why not create assessments where students are expected to work collaboratively? Why not take another step forward and make it so that your assessments cannot be completed individually, that the only way to succeed in the assessment task is by collaborating? And, you know, you could really have some fun with that. So, you know, why don't you make an assessment that cannot be completed by a physiotherapist independently? You know, make it so that your physiotherapy student has to work with a nursing student or an occupational therapy student in order to successfully complete the assessment task. I mean, that's the kind of interprofessional education that I think really makes a big difference. We talk about interprofessional education, but then we assess students within their disciplinary silos. And, you know, it makes no sense. And then we say, okay, now go be a part of a multidisciplinary team. Good luck. So I think maybe we could let go of the idea of cheating. Just change the way that we think about what assessment could be.
Yeah, I think that's definitely stimulating some thoughts in my head. Okay, let's throw that over then to the listeners. So again, we're going to pause for a couple of minutes and go back to your list and see now of the things that you stopped as in response to the pandemic, which of those would you now view as obsolete? What's there the opportunity to let go and fill those into that bottom left block on the matrix? Welcome back. Okay, so we're now on to our final box on the matrix. And this is things that we stopped in response, but that we think we do need to restart. Although what we're thinking here is it doesn't have to necessarily be restart in exactly the same form. It might be to restart in some other form. I don't know about you, I found that I had lots of stuff here. That most things I was writing, I was kind of wanting to say, well, some aspects of it, or like the best parts of this is kind of what I was wanting to restart. So, for example, things like practical teaching, you know, I mean, I think that's probably one of the ones that there's going to be a lot of commonality on, that everybody's wanting to get back to practical teaching. But I think for me, it's then about thinking, I don't know how everyone else is working, but we're in a scenario where we've definitely got reduced practical time. So it's okay, what makes the best use of that? And I've been conscious in the past, maybe not done enough to change it, that often my practical sessions, if I want them to be around kind of clinical reasoning and thinking, they end up not being very practical. So people spend a lot of time sitting down talking through stuff and not a lot of time doing. And actually, you know, again, that's not necessarily the best use of the classroom space, which can often be stretched, and it may not be the best organization of those activities. So it's being very, again, strategic and planned with that practical time, so that we actually get what I'm not wanting to go back to is a kind of like see one, do one, you know, like here's the practical technique that you all need to do. But it's how do we use that flipped approach to get students coming into a practical room with some things that they want to try out, and then problem solving in a practical way, rather than just kind of either copying a practical technique or problem solving in a more theoretical abstract way. It's what's the sort of the nice point between those. I think also things like simulation, you know, are things that have broadly seemed to have paused and had to stop. So it's thinking about, you know, that's maybe more of a just a pure restart. And I think the other thing that I had in there was just wanting to restart that the potential for sort of in-person discussion and brainstorming. I was one of the things that as I was writing this down, so I was doing this, I'd kind of like got my coloured pens out and I was mapping out into my matrix, and I thought, you know, there's something really nice about this, and there's something really nice about like a bit of flip chart paper and a group of students round it and, you know, mapping it out, and then, oh, this one isn't really working, getting a fresh sheet and kind of reorganising that. And that's one of the hardest things, I think, to replicate online. Although there's online tools that do that function, I'm not sure that we're at a comfortable point of using them where students necessarily fall into that practice in quite the same way that they would in the classroom. So being able to restart that kind of free flow of ideas that happens around a table, you know, and that could be about like developing our skills so that we're able to do that virtually better, but it could also be about kind of getting back to how we used to do it before. How about you, Michael? What did you have in that box?
Yeah, I think before I start on my list, I just want to touch on that idea of pen and paper. And I think there's something very obviously tactical about holding onto a pen and working on a piece of paper. But I think something we don't really think about very much is the kind of spatial relationships between ideas, and how pen and paper really gives us a way to look at relationships between concepts in a way that is difficult to do in a digital environment. And as you say, the tools are getting better. What I don't think it's very useful for is you know, making lists. And oftentimes you see group work devolving into this kind of using a piece of paper to write down a long list. And in those kinds of scenarios, I think, you know, it's fine to work on Google Docs or whatever. But when you're brainstorming, mind mapping, and specifically looking at relationships between things, there's a spatial component that's very difficult to do online. So I think that's a really great point. And I think that we need to bring back the best of certain activities in this area. And for me, it's definitely the way that we do our teaching. You talked about the practical component, and maybe I'll come back to that. But for me, the way that we teach in a classroom, that's something that we definitely need to get back to. We need to get back in the classroom with students. But I'd really love to see more discussion, more problem solving, and less kind of pressure on covering content. You know, we talk about our curricula that are getting bloated, and there's a lot of pressure on lecturers to make sure that they cover the content. And I think that we can move a lot of that activity out of the classroom A lot of people are looking at flipped classroom approaches. I think that's a really useful way of thinking about content. And then keep the classroom activity for discussion, for reasoning, for thinking, stimulating ideas, pushing students out of the box, getting them to push us out of our comfort areas. So I'd really like to see some of that. You mentioned the practical classroom. One of the things I'd really like to see in terms of practical training is an increased focus on principles rather than techniques. And so, you know, one of the things we had to look at and we're still looking at is, you know, which are the techniques that we're going to not cover in the year, because we just don't have time to go through all of them. And I think that's a great opportunity to say, you know, let's look at principles of practical techniques, and then we get the students to do a few at home. That we provide videos, images, text descriptions. Then they come into the classroom and we ask them to derive principles from the techniques that they've learned. So now we're talking about physics and we're talking about anatomy and kind of bringing those other ideas in. And once they've derived the principles, can they perform techniques on joints that we haven't told them about? And I think that really kind of drives a very different approach to learning. So we say, here are three techniques. Each one of these techniques emphasizes a principle. Can you figure out what that principle is? I think that would be a really interesting way of learning practical techniques in a way that gets them thinking very carefully, very deeply about what it is they're doing. And it really moves us away from this idea of, okay, I've got to put my hands here and I've got to push this hard in this direction, which I don't think is particularly useful.
Yeah, that sounds really, really interesting. And I think kind of dovetails with my thoughts there around, you know, making the use of practical time. But it sounds like what you're describing there is kind of practical problem solving. Like that's going to be most effectively done in a practical room. So you're having to test out what the principle and how you might apply that principle onto a different joint. But it's certainly getting students to apply and think at those sort of higher levels. One of the other things I had in there, actually kind of touching on what you were saying about discussion and kind of getting back to the discussion in the classroom, it was in relation to assessment. So one of the things I missed, one of the changes that I made to one of the assessments, which would have been a kind of poster presentation in a classroom where the student would present, and then there's some opportunity for questions to sort of dig in a little bit deeper, we changed to being a recorded presentation. And I really missed the opportunity just to have that sort of 3 minutes or so of questioning where you could just pick up on something that didn't quite make sense. And so that idea of discussion, being able to enhance my understanding of where the student's coming from on something, I missed in that format of assessment. So being able to go back to doing that either in person, or I mean that could have been done synchronously online. So that was partly a function of the move to asynchronous. But being able to have the scope for discussion as part of assessment, I think is definitely something that is going to be important to keep hold of as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that ability to get kind of real time feedback from students in the moment, and then to adapt based on what they're going through, what they're thinking about, I think is essential. And it really works well when you're in the classroom with the students. Especially when you're working in small groups and you're kind of moving around to each of the groups, you know, there's so much that can be learned in those environments. And then you kind of feed back into the larger group, talk about what are the main problems that people were experiencing, what are the main misunderstandings, do a little bit of revision. You know, I think, you know, those are the kinds of things that really make, well, for me, that I look forward to the most in the classroom. And that's something that I miss a lot. You know, now that we're trying to do all of this at a distance.
Right. So I guess this is the opportunity now for you to think about what things you're missing most and what things you'd want to put back into that restart box in whichever form. So again, we're going to pause, do our final pause here for you to complete your matrix. You may find as you're doing this and as you've been listening to us that actually your thoughts have changed on sort of which box things fit best into. You might find there's still some things on your list at the end which you haven't allocated yet, and it's absolutely fine to move stuff around and maybe take this final pause as the opportunity to sort of make any of those sort of changes that you want to make now, so that you're sort of comfortable broadly speaking with the map that you've laid out. We'll see you back in a couple of minutes.
Okay, welcome back. We hope that you've enjoyed this opportunity to reflect on some of the changes that you've made in your programs as part of your teaching practice. We talked about some of the things that you would have started and which needed to end, the temporary measures that you took. We've talked about the innovative practices that you've implemented in your departments that you might want to think about doing more of. So those are the new practices that you want to take forward. And then there were some of the old practices that we've stopped and realized that some of these things are obsolete and we actually need to let them go and move on. But then there are activities, the best parts of some activities that we need to restart. And you know, we talked about some of the things that we miss most about being with students in the classroom. And so, you know, to wrap this reflection up, for myself, this was a really useful way to think about some of the changes that we've made. We tend to kind of collapse all of the changes into one big blob. And I thought that this crisis response framework from the RSA was a really useful way for me to think about my own practice and think carefully about what we want to hold on to as we move forward and what are the things that we can let go of. So I hope it was useful for you, as useful for you as it was for me.
Yeah, so what happens next? So what we're going to do is we're going to be having a synchronous discussion on day two of the UNConference. So that's at 10 o'clock UTC on the 15th of September. So hopefully you've listened to this, you've drawn out your matrix in some form. That could be on paper or you could have done it on the computer. That's totally up to you. What we'd like you to do is to share that on the Padlet that's on the podcast page of the UNConference Hub. So if you've done it on paper, take a picture, post that into there. If you've done it on a Google Doc, share the link for that so we can view. And if you can try and do that for at least an hour before the synchronous discussion, because what we'd like you to do is to go back on and just have a little look at the sorts of things that have been cropping up in other people's matrices. You don't need to look at absolutely all of them. What we're going to do in the synchronous chat is look for the themes and the sort of commonalities across what everyone's had, and also try and orientate our thinking a little bit more towards sort of what are the concrete actions that we're going to take from this point forwards. So we hope that some of you are going to join us. And as I say, if you come to that ready to sort of, you know, share the reflections that you've had so far and listen to and expand on those with other people, that's kind of how that session's going to go. So I hope to see you 10 o'clock on the 15th of September. To join that, just go to the UNConference Hub or to the schedule page and you'll be able to click on the link straight through into the Jitsi video call from there. So we'll wrap up from here. And see you soon to carry on the conversation.